Mike, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks. Good.
Glad to have you here.
Hi, everybody.
I asked a conspiracy music guru if he'd be here to listen to you, and he says, no, I have to listen to that guy every day. Don't make me listen to him again. So he's not going to be here to listen to you. There you go. Take it away. It's all yours.
All right. So let's see. You're seeing me right now, right?
But
you
see.
Want to see. I want to share my screen first.
Okay.
Share screen. Share sound. Screen two. There we go. You should see a mountain that looks a lot like an elephant.
Got it.
All right. Good. So let's get started. So I've called this, well, first of all, it's really an honor to be invited here and to speak with you all. Fun to be part of this event. And I've titled this talk Biogeology 101. Anyone who's been to university and has taken the 101 courses knows that that's where a lot of the indoctrination and lies reside. So I thought this was a good title. Biogeology is a term that I've appropriated, and I'll explain it more in a moment. This is what I'll be touching on today. Petrogenesis, the origin of stone, rapid petrification, petrified titans, soft tissue, and trees. So what is biogeology? Like I said, it's a term I've appropriated to denote the intimate connection between biogeology, geology, petrogenesis, and petrification. The mainstream definition is listed below, but it's little used, and I thought it was much better to explain as a term to really talk about. Hold on, just got something in the way here. My notes. So I meant it as an umbrella term to describe the myriad of different ways in which the biological material can turn to stone. And we know about fossilization, we know about petrification, and we'll talk more about all of those things. So this is kind of where I was at a long time ago, long before Earth shape came into the equation. I realized that a lot of the stuff that I was fed was BS, and that basically I was going through the public indoctrination system. And as I went into university, you'll see my qualifications here. So I have a bachelor's in Italian cultural studies. Then I went to a five-year university for chiropractic, and I did my master's thesis in the effects of spinal manipulation on visceral disease. In other words, organs, problems with organs. And so as I said before, I saw pretty early on that there were a lot of problems with the university system. A lot of it was an appeal to authority, statistical manipulation, that money was steering research, and, you know, there was a lot of compartmentalization as well. So, and I just want to make sure I'm not on the screen right now.
Okay, don't you don't want to be on the screen. Got you.
Go ahead. I don't want to block the images. So,
can I ever get you?
Great. Okay. So I'll just say up front, I have no background in geology, so I'm not an expert whatsoever in geology. So take everything I say today with a grain of salt, because this is all just self-study. But I think that this is really what we need in general is cross-disciplinary approaches to research, because there's, like I said, so much compartmentalization that people have a tendency to become experts in their little field and not have a clue about what's going on in the rest of the world. So I call it expertitis. So some people mock those who are doing their own research, but I think that we need to, and that is actually a logical fallacy. It's an appeal to authority, and we don't need to be experts in a field to recognize that an argument is cogent, or that the person we're listening to might be using all sorts of different logical fallacies. So cross-disciplinary, that's what we want. So I woke up to the moon landing hoax years and years and years ago. And I knew of NASA's hoaxery, but it never occurred to me that they might have been faking everything since the 60s. And I never even began to question the heliocentric model until I met this guy. When I met him, I was a space sci-fi junkie, and I was believing that we needed to colonize space before we ruined this place. But I was awake to a whole lot of different kinds of deceptions. And he and I started comparing notes, 9/11, fluoride, chemtrails, moon landings. We were just checking them off one by one. And then he brought up the subject of flat Earth. And I thought, oh no, I can never trust a word this guy says again. Because if he's willing to believe that, he's willing to believe anything. And he challenged me to go prove what I believed. And so I thought it was going to take me about 5 minutes. I said, what about the pictures of space? And what about the ISS and all of that? And one by one, he just shot down the things that I brought him. And so one day I went out with my camera, my Samsung telephone, nothing fancy, no super zoom lens or anything. And I caught a photograph of Ibiza from 90 kilometers away. And I was really good at geometry in high school. And I started to run the numbers, and I looked at the different ways it was calculated. And I soon learned that 200 meters of that island should have been obscured. So basically, let me just bring up a pointer here. This peak and this peak, these are two highest points of Ibiza. This saddle between them sits at 200 meters. And at that distance and my viewing altitude of 134 meters, that saddle should have been on the horizon. I shouldn't have been able to see any of it. And it became obvious to me that even without any powerful optics, just my telephone on a clear winter's day, I was able to see all 200 of the missing meters. So I started looking into different, I started to consider that maybe there was more to the old cosmologies and the mythologies that I'd given credence to. And I thought, what a fun exercise. We've got all these things that we're not really allowed to question, because if you question them, you're considered an idiot. Heliocentrism being number one, Earth shape, gravity, timelines, all of that stuff. And I think it's fun to engage in intellectual exercises and to do it with intellectual honesty. So funnily enough, 2 weeks ago, I went out again. I'd always wanted to catch a picture of Ibiza from the sea level, because I'd taken those other shots at 134 meters altitude. And a couple of weeks ago, I was out with Alex and Dave Monell and his family, and I caught this picture with the same telephone at sea level, three meters altitude, and an even further distance. That's 95 kilometers away. And at that distance and that viewing altitude, the top peak of Ibiza should be over 100 meters below the curve. And obviously, you're seeing a fair amount of the island there beyond the atmospheric occlusion. So after Alex woke me up to the possibility that the Earth might not be what we thought and what we were taught, I started to come across all kinds of other little rabbit holes that I went down, things like star forts and mud floods and Tartaria. And then eventually saw the video No Forests on Earth, which really kind of got my imagination going, and a video by Wakey Wakey called Geology Revived, in which he was really kind of dismantling some of the cornerstones of geology and things like dating and how long it takes for things to petrify and that sort of thing. So I started to realize that, once you realize that maybe heliocentrism is a total lie, then pretty much anything is up for grabs, and it's time to start looking at everything with new eyes. So I started doing that with geology. Then I came across these two guys. The lower left is Mud Fossil University's Roger Spur. Upper right is a guy named Alan. I don't recall his last name. He had a channel called Flat Earth Nation. And he was talking about Nephorensics, which is basically the Nephilim, the fallen angels that everything had been turned to stone, and the stones as we knew them were body parts. And that was the same thing that Roger was saying, was his mud fossil theory was that pretty much all of the stones that we see are biology in one way or another. And mainstream geology says something similar. I'm going to do a little 2-minute crash course in that in a moment. But it was a little far-fetched when he started talking about 1,000-mile dragons in the Sahara. I couldn't figure out how those could exist on a ball that was 24,901 miles in circumference. But I like the mud fossil idea, and started just looking at into things a little differently. And then this whole idea of Titans really fascinated me. Clash of the Titans was one of my favorite movies when I was a kid. And then I saw this video by Jay Dreamers, and that was really when the penny dropped for me. He started kind of synthesizing the work of Roger Spurr, looking at mythology, looking at religion, looking at different texts, and also questioning the geological narrative. And that was when I started to ponder this mountain, which is in the town that I live in, which is affectionately known as the Elephant, and to many looks a lot like an elephant. And I had hiked this mountain for over 6 years at that point, 7 years before I talked with Alex, six or 7 years. I'd been up to the top many times. I'd been up to that cave, which looks like an eye socket, a zillion times. And so I thought, this is just unbelievable. I got on Google Earth. I started looking at it in 3D, tilting and checking it out, and realized that there isn't just a cave right in the right spot where the eye socket should be, but there was also the what appeared to be the remains of a rib cage, and there were two curves in the mountain right where the head would meet the shoulders of this creature, and there was a big canyon which I had hiked up multiple times right between where legs would be. And so right off the bat, I realized that there were a good 10 or 12 different anatomical features beyond just this thing looking from an elephant from one angle. And so that really was a mind blow. And I decided, okay, well, I'd been seeing all kinds of pictures like this. This is a real common thing of, people are posting these pictures and claiming that they're Titans or claiming that they're giants. And a lot of times it's, shadows and foliage and different things. And you always see the same angle with this stuff. You never get any boots on the ground. So I was really hesitant to get into this. And I decided that, I got to be careful. If you open your mind too much, your brain might fall out. So these were some of the problems that I was having with the mud fossil Titan research. I won't go into each of them because I want to get to a lot of stuff at the end. So, but pareidolia is what you see on the right there. You see a face in something when it's not really there. Photos from one angle, shadows. Like I said, a lot of people are photoshopping the images, and a lot of people are just claiming that because it looks like something, it is something. And there's no additional investigation whatsoever ever. There's no anatomical analysis, histological analysis, no microscopy, nothing. And so I decided I wasn't going to approach it that way. I was going to go out and get my anatomy books out and approach it in a more methodical manner. So just for a little crash course in what they call petrogenesis, this is how it's said to begin. Foliage, wildlife dies, goes under the sea floor, gets compressed into sedimentary layers, eventually becomes metamorphic rock as it gets compressed and it gets pushed downward towards the Earth's core, where that rock will eventually melt and become magma. And then it's spewed out in volcanoes in the form of igneous rock. It's called the cycle of petrogenesis, and this is what it looks like. And so that's how all of our stone is explained. And they have all of these different layers that they talk about, and they've got fancy names for each of them. And they're talking about timelines of tens of thousands to hundreds of millions of years, even billions of years. And this whole timeline also very conveniently justifies the heliocentric model as well, because we're talking about a 16.4 billion year universe, and then the Earth being 4.6 billion years. And so there's a lot of circular reasoning. This is one of the things that I learned from the Wakey Wakey video, and that there's, you know, they tell us how old things are based on the layer they're in, but then they tell us how old the layer is based on the things that are in the layer. And this can be easily debunked, and it's been debunked by a geologist looking at the slurry flows that occurred after Mount St. Helens erupted, where we got all these micro layers of strata in a matter of literally hours. So that would normally be, you know, tens of thousands or maybe even a million years of layering of strata. And I question whether that makes any sense at all when you see photographs like this. How does that make sense? That these are just formed by things just laying down and layering and compressing and then eventually kind of melting a little bit and becoming a mix of things. This is something known as banded iron. Looks a heck of a lot like a tree ring. So if you think about this, nature would have had to do one thing and then another, and then go back to the other thing, and then back to another, and then back to the other thing. And it's all in these swirls. So how does that work with the sedimentary layering? To me, it just doesn't make any sense. These are salt formations, salt mountains. Same question. Incredible complexity there. This is where we get our Himalayan salt from. And you can see, again, it's this banding. And I think it's far more likely that what we're looking at are different ways in which things petrify, and very likely trees. So take it, just kind of remember this image, because later on we'll see something very, very similar to this. So these, the upper left and the lower right, are marble caves. You can see these concentric rings. So that doesn't make sense very much when it comes to the layering, and then again with the salt formations. These are salt mines. And if you look at the grain, looks a heck of a lot like tree, doesn't it? And this is sandstone. Sandstone dwellings. Now, a lot of people want to say that that's melted building. I think it's far more likely that what we're looking at are the remains of the giant trees. That was Petra a moment ago. This is also Petra. You can see the detail of the grain. It doesn't, that can't be a melted building. All of these are explained in one convoluted way or another based on the tales of geology. But the question is, can they prove any of it? Can you see it occurring? No, it happened millions of years ago, just like with the basalt columns. Look at that upper right. How does that happen? So they tell us that the basalt columns are formed by cooling lava. I completely rebuke the notion. When have we ever seen lava do this? There's still active volcanoes. Stuff's pouring out of them. It cools. It hardens. I'd love to have anyone show me an example of it forming hexagonal columns. So back to the mountain. So I decided to approach it with the scientific method in mind. I made observations. I thought of interesting questions. I formulated a hypothesis. What if it really were a gigantic being? How would I go about testing that? And I developed some testable predictions. For example, and I already mentioned these. Oh, no, I didn't. Okay. So got ahead of myself there. So these are the things I wanted to avoid when I started doing this research. Apophenia is basically the same as pareidolia, but you're recognizing a pattern that actually doesn't exist. Pareidolia is the same thing, but visual. Cherry picking is when you just pick the things you like and you tell people about those and you ignore the things that conflict with your idea. Dunning-Kruger effect is when you think you know something about something, but you really don't. You're just a novice, but you think you're an expert. That's what any geologist in the world would say about me when it comes to all of this stuff. And when it comes to things like Titans, they would just say there's no evidence. They would dismiss it with a hand wave. They talk about the doctrine of signatures. That's when things look like things. Again, it's just another term for like a flower that grows and looks like a monkey, and things look like stuff. But for the most part, it's just hand wave dismissals, including some very prominent flat earthers. Ironically, you'd think flat earthers would be some of the most open-minded people in the world, and some of them are some of the most closed-minded people I've ever met. So my approach to all of this was the Google Earth footage. I did anatomical histological correlations. Histology is just the study of tissue. So I imagine myself as being a microscope. So if you're looking at a mountain that's 3 miles long and 753 meters, what is that? Almost a kilometer tall, 6/10 of a mile tall. What, you know, that you're talking about something so big, you are essentially a microscope. And then I took microscopes to the mountain as well. I did CAT scans of the heart stones and endoscopy, which we'll get to in a moment, the heart stones. And I started looking at a lot of the historical, religious, mythological texts and things that were being said. So I got out my anatomy book. As I said, I started looking at elephant anatomy. Doesn't necessarily have to be an elephant. Bob Nodell, rest in peace, he called it a pachyderm, and I didn't even know the term. I learned it from him, but things like anteaters are pachyderms. So there's a whole family of these creatures that have long snouts. Doesn't have to be an elephant. Someone said it looked like a whale. Could be a whale. A whale's also a vertebrate. I do believe it's a vertebrate. The eye is positioned correctly. So anyway, I started looking at things, and we'll see here in a moment how this correlates to the mountain. But an eye socket has seven bones. They all meet in different places. Those are known as sutures. Then you have fissures in between, which is where the optic nerve goes. There are other little channels that go down. This channel here leads down into the sinuses, which is what you see here, channel going down and the sinuses. And then you have all of these key meeting points. This is a key point here, which I'll come back to in a second. So looking on Google Earth, I could see right off the bat that there was a line here. You can't see it, the whole thing in the picture, but that was right where this line is. There's a cave here, which you're actually looking through here, and that cave is exactly where this would be. This is what's known as the infraorbital foramen. All vertebrates have this in the skull. And if the head were tilted backward, which is what it appears that is going on with the mountain, then that would be pointing forward, which is exactly what you see here. So already that was just a crazy number of coincidences, even without having gone up and exploring inside the cave. So started looking at it with 3D software, looking at all the bones, looking at how everything connects, went up there and started getting some photographs, some footage. And I was absolutely blown away with what I found on that first visit. So what you're seeing here, this is the temporal fossa. It's one of the chewing muscles. This is the eye socket. So this is not the eye. This is the eye socket. And if you look up close here, there's a line here. That's one of those suture lines I was talking about where the frontal bone meets the maxilla. And this is this portion would be missing. So that was one of the craziest things I saw right off the bat, was at that exact point where those two bones meet is this structure in the inside the cave. I mean, what are the odds of that? Right here, this is an elephant skull. This is what's known as the optic fissure. That's where the optic nerve goes. And in that exact portion in the cave is this, which is just mind-blowing. So, and it continued from there. I started to theorize that if the eye socket was so well preserved, then perhaps there was an ear, because looking at it on Google Earth, there's this quarter moon shaped discoloration right in front of where the shoulder would meet the head. And that was this cutout that I was talking about. And so that was when it really started to be kind of twilight zoney. And the reason for that is I hypothesized that there might be a cave up there. And I went looking for the cave. And when I did, I started online first to find out. Oops. Hold on. Well, you can see it here. So that was pretty wild. I went looking for an ear cave, and I found out that a team of archaeologists had gone up and investigated an ear that was right here in the middle of this quarter moon formation, where it looks like an ear was once attached. These guys went up and they did the most thorough investigation of any cave in Europe at the time that they conducted this investigation. They went up with 3D mapping technology. They went up with 3D photography. There were cave paintings, which you saw on the walls that looked like four-legged creatures. I'll just show it again. I wanted to pause it, but I can't figure out where to pause it. That's the 3D mapping of the inside of the cave, which ironically matches where, and that looks like a cochlea to me, but. Anyway, so it just got weirder and weirder. About a year later, I went up with some friends. At this point, I'd made about four or five videos, and we discovered that this section here of the mountain, which you can see right there, which I originally... Oh, wait, there's a bunch of chat stuff going on. Make sure everybody's still hearing me. Oh, okay. No, that's just the chat. All right. So this, I had theorized right off the bat when I went up there the first time that this was the remains of the eyeball. It sounds far-fetched, but when I was up there with a couple of friends, Andreas Exertis and Victor Bugay, shout out to them. One of them recognized that the backside of this structure, which I had climbed up on multiple times, was entirely encased in a 10-inch thick layer of crystal. And you can see the thick layer here. So if you think about an eyeball, one of my theories in biogeology is that things that are fat will petrify to quartz. So the whole eyeball, the outer portion, the sclera of the eyeball is fat. And then this chunky portion here is where the optic nerve attaches into the back of the eye socket. And so this whole structure is one kind of stone, but the entire backside is covered with that crystal. So it was just one more of many, many correlations that were very, very specific. Just in the eye socket alone, there's upwards of about 20 anatomical correlations, which is pretty odd if it's something that is just pareidolia. Like, what's going on? Is the universe just messing with me? Is this a cosmic joke? Well, after I made a video talking about that and came back, no, actually, I made the fourth video on the tissues of the mountain, on the histology, and I took the microscope to it, and that was when I went in an interview with Rodrigo Ferrari Nunez to show him the mountain again on Google Earth. And when I went to do that, I noticed that all of a sudden, all of this section here had been blurred out. And it wasn't like that before. I'd gone in hundreds of times when I was doing the research, looking at this mountain. And all of a sudden, it was different. And you could call it a rendering glitch or something odd, but up in the left there, you can see the footage that I got in the initial videos, because I was using Google Earth as if it were a drone. And then the after below is what happened after I made the fourth video. What are the odds? It's almost like it's winking at you. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, right? So what am I doing on time? 30 minutes. Okay, I think I'm okay. So I made a fifth video, Unveiling a Titan Part 5, New Discoveries, and Google Earth Censorship. And then in the sixth video, I went and addressed a whole bunch of other items, including the microscopy portion of the whole thing. So this is a list of the coincidences that have been compiled to date. That's the first 25 of them. And here's the other 31 of them. So that is a big number. If anyone likes to play games of chance, you can ask yourself, what are the odds of such a thing? So again, I was having problems with a lot of what I was seeing in the rest of the so-called mud fossil Titan research community. I put research in quotes there because basically what you're finding is a lot of point and claim and a lot of photographs and not a whole lot of investigation. So one of the things that I hit upon, and I literally asked God, like, send me some undeniable example of a mud fossil, because I was still believing that mud fossil theory was what was going on with this stuff, even though I felt it was highly unlikely that a 753 meter tall mountain would have been buried in mud, and then that mud would stay there long enough for the thing to petrify. Because in mud fossil theory, the basic idea is that something has to be encased in mud in order to be preserved, because the anaerobic bacteria, the bacteria and the larvae that would normally eat away at the flesh of something before it has a chance to petrify, they're not present when something is surrounded in mud. And so that's kind of the basic idea, is that the minerals that are in the mud, they're working their way into the tissue while the water and the gas is leaching its way out. So I asked the universe for a sign, and I found this rock a few days later, and I picked it up in the river bottom. It's about four times the size of a human heart. And I started noticing that it had a whole bunch of anatomical features that matched up with the heart. On the right there, you're seeing what's known as the isthmus. This is the space between the pulmonary arteries. This indent, or this these bumps on the side, are believed to be the papillary muscles. This would be the aorta and the vena cava. This is the coronary sulcus, and the outer portion is white, and you can see it's almost red on this side where portions of the stone have worn away. And this outer portion would be the pericardium, which is the thick fatty sac that protects the heart. So again, I decided to go back to my anatomy books. I started looking at all kinds of different hearts. They come in lots of different shapes and sizes, depending on the species of the creature. But they all have these general things that are in common. They all have an aorta and a vena cava, the two biggest blood vessels in the body. They have these different lines, these fatty segments. So I made a video called Mud Fossils, the Heart of the Matter. And I showed with video and endoscopy, got a camera, got inside the stone, and mapped out these 24 different anatomical features in that one stone. But I figured, going back to the scientific method, that if it was possible that a organ could petrify, which mainstream geology tells us is not possible, then, you know, how would that happen? I didn't know. But I figured if it was a phenomenon that was real, that I should be able to find others. So I went back out into the field to try and find more. And I got to do that, and I found a whole bunch of stones that started to match this pattern, and I started to recognize that there was a pattern in the stones that I was never taught existed. And now, mainstream geology tells us that those rocks on the right there are what are known as polycalcitic conglomerate cobbles. And I'll break down the word for you. Poly means many. Calcitic means a bunch of different types of calcite. Conglomerate means it's a mix of different kinds of mud that was in some kind of a slurry flow. And cobblestone is just the name of that particular kind of stone, like they use on the cobblestone roads on in the old cities. So that's what they're telling us. This was a lump of clay that got compressed and became metamorphic rocks. It was on its way to melting into magma and becoming igneous rock eventually in that cycle of petrogenesis. But these stones have some very, very specific features, which I'll go into. So I started to find them in all different sizes. So it was a repeatable phenomenon. It was scalable. Now, some will say that's cherry picking, but it is in the sense that I'm picking out the ones that are matching the anatomical correlations. So I went out into the field again. I broke a bunch of them open. In this video, I show what they look like inside. They're white on the outside, and several of them had chambers and what looked to be blood inside. I took some of them and got them CAT scanned. You can see the patients there in the lower left. Spent 400 euros of my own money to have that done. And you can see right there on the left that, oh, it's looping. But you can see the aortas and the vena cava. The endoscopy is here, looking at the inside. Then I thought, okay, I'm going to challenge myself. I'm going to go out live. And I'm going to film while I find these stones and show that it's not just cherry picking, that I'm going to find way too many given the anatomical specificity. The more items I add to a list of what I'm looking for in a stone, the harder it should be to find that kind of a stone. And in less than an hour, I found a whole bunch of them that I shared in that video. Then I took a bunch of them over. Alex had a grinder and we sliced a bunch of them open and I polished them. I show that in that video. And then here you can see some of these reoccurring specificities. Up at the top is where the blood vessels would be. There's this harp shape. There are these things called sulcus lines where the folds of the heart, which I'll show you in a moment, meet. And it gets very, very specific. I had a lot of people asking me questions, how is this possible? Why are the organs found outside the body? I didn't know. I just knew that in some way the rest of the body had to have been destroyed while the organs were hardened. How is that possible? I don't know. I theorized maybe high heat. And then it occurred to me, I came up with what I call boiled egg theory, that the organs are all housed in this thick, fatty sac. The heart has the thickest of them, which is known as the pericardium. And I thought, okay, that's a protective sac. And then the organs are floating in the abdominal and the chest cavities, and they're in an even thicker sac called the pleura, that protects all of the organs. So I thought, wow, that's kind of like a pressure cooker. And I started thinking about eggs and how quickly they harden, because if you think of our organs, they're made of a lot of proteins, just like the eggs are. And also the human serum albumin that you see here, this is 55% of blood plasma is basically made of these long chain fatty acids. So if you remove all of the water from blood, you end up with crystal. So this totally fits with the whole idea that all of these different things are going to turn to crystal in one way or another in my theories related to biogeology. And then people are like, well, where are the bones? Because that's what we always find when it comes to fossils, right? The bones are what we're told are preserved. Well, I didn't know, but eventually a friend turned me on to the idea that that when you have a crock pot, which is what I was just describing a moment ago, the body is essentially a crock pot, Then, hold on 1 second. Turn off that. How do I hit play? The play button disappeared. There we go. No.
Try the space bar. Okay. Sometimes it might work.
All right. No, it just switches. The space bar switches to the next slide.
Oh.
All right. Oh, wait. Maybe there? No. Anyway, what that was going to show you is that if you take these bones and you put them in a crock pot for a number of hours at relatively low heat, in 6 or 7 hours, they're going to turn to sponge. And if you keep going with it, they're going to turn to like a gelatinous substance. And so my theory was that the bones were being dissolved in some way while the organs were hardening. So the two theories went hand in hand. It wasn't so far-fetched. There's this guy in the 1800s, Girolamo Sagatto, who had the secret to petrifying any type of flesh in the body. And his handiwork can be found in museums to this day. He was known as the petrificator. And the secret supposedly died with him, but he was able to petrify organs and anything he wanted to that was made out of flesh. And there was another man named Paolo Guarini who also knew how to do it. And he petrified, I have some photographs of petrified brains. Now, I didn't know about this until some months ago. These are called bog bodies. And this is what happens when a body falls into a peat bog that's very acidic. And ironically, what happens, and this gets back to the whole, the theory relating to the bones dissolving, is that a peat bog has a really strange effect on the body. It will dissolve all of the bones and it will cause the organs to harden and the skin is preserved. So if the organs were to harden and then eventually the skin disappears, then it's not so far-fetched to think that something else could take place that would continue the hardening process of the organs and turn them to stone. This is Mother Shipton's cave. This is a place with high mineral content waters where things within a matter of months will start to be encased and then eventually turn to solid stone. So it's a pretty fascinating place. This is Lake Natron. Natron is an important component in geopolymers, so turning things to stone. This is a lake that has a very high ash and natron component, and when things fall in it, they don't come out. This is an artist has taken some of the animals that have fallen in and have died, and he's repositioned them while they were still relatively soft to create these photographs. But this is just another example of rapid petrification. So that was kind of all the stuff that I was looking into. And then at one point, somebody in the comment thread of one of my videos mentioned this guy, Francisco Torrent Guasp. I'd never heard of him. Someone said that the heart is a rope. I said, well, it didn't make any sense to me. And then someone else said, the heart is a rope. And so I went and I watched this documentary, and it was literally life-changing for me, because the stuff that this man discovered decades ago that have still not been disseminated into mainstream consciousness they're absolutely phenomenal. So I've got a little 1 minute video here that just talks about his life. Hopefully the sound isn't too loud.
Did you know that almost everything you were taught about the heart is wrong? Most everyone today, even doctors, still believe the heart to be a four-chamber pump that pushes blood through a mind-boggling 60,000 miles of narrowing blood vessels to fuel our 40 trillion cells, then filling again as if by magic on relaxation. Well, that theory was thoroughly debunked by the Spanish cardiologist Francisco Torrent Guasp back in 1972. After dissecting thousands of hearts, Guasp finally discovered the heart's true structure. The heart's far more amazing than we ever knew. It's like a rope, a long tube wrapped into a knot. Instead of being pushed, the blood is pulled through the heart in two spiraling vortexes.
See those lines there?
This has been proven with CAT scans, functional MRI, and positronic emission. Look at the spiraling contraction. It changes everything we know about the heart and circulation. If you'd like to know more, check out these videos.
Oh, I figured out how to do it now. I had to get rid of the laser pointer. So here, this was the mind blow for me. When he rolled this heart back up and he presented it, I saw these lines here, and I realized that a bunch of the stones that I had gathered had those lines in them in the same places. And I hadn't really noticed it as a reoccurring phenomenon. Also, the bottom of the heart is right here. If you see that, it's twisting as it's contracting.
Even doctors still believe the heart to be a four-chamber pump that pushes blood through a mind-boggling 60,000 miles.
Technology that we've been taught everything wrong about it. I went to chiropractic college. I loved the when we were studying the heart. I knew the anatomy inside and out, and we were never told this. I've met cardiologists who've never even heard of this man, which is absolutely astonishing. He should have gotten the Nobel Prize, but. Yeah, so these spirals here,
into a knot.
They proved
instead
it.
Of being pushed, the blood is pulled through the heart in two spiraling vortexes.
This
has been proven with CAT scans, functional MRI, and positronic emission.
This ties into the work of Victor Schauberger and how water vortexes, and it's just amazing. I've got a number of videos on this subject on my channel, but here with positronic emission, they're showing from above that it's spiral contraction, but not just of the blood flow, but also the fibers themselves are spiraling. If you look here,
look at the spiraling contraction. It changes everything we know
That's
about
a CAT
the heart
scan
and circulation. If you'd like to know more, check out these videos.
Yeah, so that was a huge thing for me, because then I noticed that these lines here and the spirals, that those were in the stones, and the bottom of these stones was almost like a spiral, like a propeller blade. So I made a video about it called Helical Hearts, Petrified Organs and Synchronicities. And synchronicity has just followed me through this entire venture. I've done entire videos on the subject of synchronicity and how it's led to these different discoveries. And one of the biggest synchronicities of all was that this doctor, Francisco Torrent Guasp, he lived and worked his entire career in a town called Denia, which is at the foot of Mont Gaux. So this mountain, the Elephant Mountain that I've done all this research on, he was living and working in a family practice literally at the foot of Mont Gaux for decades. What are the odds of that? And then this is the petrified hearts evaluation criteria. So if you get to know the anatomy of this stuff, and I've got a lot of videos on my channel to show, a lot of people see my videos and then they just see kind of a lump of a rock that kind of reminds them of what they've seen in the videos. And then they send them to me and they're excited. And I don't like to burst people's bubbles, but there has to be a lot of specificity before I'm going to jump on board and say, yeah, I think you might have a heart there. But people have sent me examples that are far better than the ones I found from all around the world. So these are empirical finds. There's a high degree of anatomical, histological, and anatomical specificity. It's a repeating pattern. They are scalable. I found them from millimeters up to many millimeters. It's predictable. I found some that were partially buried and predicted what the other side of the stone looked like before I pulled it out of the mud. And sure enough, I was correct. There's a logical consistency to all of the things that I'm talking about. And it's very specified complexity. So this is where we get into probability and the question of, is this self-evident? But we were just taught not to see it because we were told a bunch of bull about how rocks form and how long it takes. I think ultimately we're talking about a term that I coined called paradigm blindness, which I think most experts are suffering from in their fields because of the compartmentalization and because we've been fed so many lies. So these are examples of some of the other stones that have been sent to me from around the world by subscribers. So how could this have been missed? Well, I just touched on it. Paradigm blindness expertitis, right? Itis means inflammation. So it's an inflammation of somebody who thinks they're an expert in things. And the compartmentalization of academia, not just academia, but also corporations and the military industrial complex and the government. So another thing is geologists are clearly not anatomists and vice versa. So they're not going to recognize this stuff unless they happen to have also studied. And even if they did study anatomy in some detail, they're probably going to dismiss the similarities they see because it couldn't be possible. Or is it possible that there's been intentional obfuscation and that they don't want us to know these things? And so, you know, that gets into the big question of why the grand lie. And I think it has to do with things like the justification of the heliocentric model, the justification of these incredibly long timelines, manufacturing scarcity, because I think ultimately if titanic trees and titanic beings were a thing and they know it and they've convinced everyone else that they're just fairy tale, then they would have a much better jump on where all of the resources are and how to find them properly, because everyone else is chasing their tail and doesn't know that, hey, you're actually looking at a big tree here, or you're looking at what may have once been a giant creature. And if that's the case, then you're going to have a much better idea about where to find all those precious gems and metals. So I think it has to do with sequestering resources. Some ask, where are the big trees and where are these large creatures? And I think probably when it comes to the miners that built the ancient realm, they probably took the low-hanging fruit first, which was everything that was on the surface. So just a reminder, petrification is an indisputable fact. We know that there are petrified trees. We've got concretions with creatures that were petrified instantaneously. The petrification can have incredible detail. I go into this a lot in the different, especially the live streams on my channel. I didn't know this until this year, but opal comes from tree, petrified tree. Got this stuff. I suppose this could be man-made, but this looks a heck of a lot like petrified stomach lining to a whale or something even bigger. People have sent me these pictures of petrified acorns. Things can petrify in a very, very short amount of time. So this gets into one of my questions, which is, what are geodes really? The human body creates stones. We have kidney stones, gallstones, bladder stones. There are stones called bezoars, which grow inside of cows and horses that can be the size of a baseball. This is what they look like in a cross section. They grow like rings of a tree, just like the agates that we see. And there can be an incredibly large number of stones in human body because, a single gallbladder can have hundreds. If something like a lymph node can petrify, there are over 600 lymph nodes in the human body. And I think it's safe to operate under the assumption that everything can petrify because everything has been found to be petrified. Even things like jellyfish, which are incredibly soft and should not be able to petrify, they've been found with all of their detail, all plant life. There are examples of fish eating other fish that are petrified and creatures in the process of giving birth. Some might have come across this recently with the Maui fires.
There's some like videos going around the internet of some interesting bodies, notably like the cat that's like left standing up, and then the dog that's in the street, and also like the people laying on the road too. One of them with a special kind of like hairstyle, and I don't really know if we're gonna get many bodies to be able to analyze what's going on, but I was able to get something from ground zero.
Because he was in ground zero for how long?
2 weeks. And this right here.
This is the camera.
Is a toad that is petrified or mummified in mid-leap. So you can see the angle of it. It's not squatting down. It's very symmetrical.
Watch when he shows the bottom. There's incredible detail because from the top,
you see those legs just jumping.
You could have doubts.
So whatever,
like, is this something
happened,
he could have made or
happened in
made
a
in a cast
second.
Or something? But when he shows it from the bottom, you can see that there's a lot of detail there.
So this was from Maui Ground Zero.
Yep, I sifted it from the ashes where there was melted aluminum 20 feet away.
So this frog should have turned to ash.
It even has some ashes on the bottom.
There you go.
Gray.
See that? Look at all that detail. See the muscle fibers and stuff. So I'm going to just scream through these. I'm not even going to talk about them. Why do things petrify? There's a lot of different theories. Each one of these slides here is a presentation in and of itself. Supernatural possibilities, artificial. I mentioned Girolamo Sagatto already. Things can be petrified very quickly. I've shown videos of rubies being made in a microwave using plasma in a matter of seconds. So that's a 2 on the hardness scale, or a 9 on the hardness scale, diamond being a 10. So if something that's that hard can be made in seconds from powders, what else is possible? And I've shown in my videos examples of petrified wood that have been created in labs in days. People can grow opals, coalification, biochar. Topher Gardner, he makes biochar. Coal can be made. It's all made from trees. So everything is coming from the trees, in my opinion, and perhaps Titans. A guy sent me a story about his dog. He burned it on a pyre after it passed away. And after 36 hours of burning, only the heart remained and it was hardened. So there's all kinds of really weird, bizarre, anomalous examples of petrification, even though we're told that such things are not possible. There's actual empirical evidence that it is possible. I showed pictures before of petrified brains in earlier in this presentation. So now, with the remaining 4 minutes, just talking about the great trees, cave and tunnel systems, lava tubes, the Action-Venture twins, all of these things suggest that the great trees were real and not just fairy tale like we were taught. The stumps were what initially were interesting to people. With the no forests on Earth, no forests on flat Earth video, but it wasn't enough for me to throw my hat in and get involved, or what do you say? No, I can't remember the metaphor, but get involved and start producing videos, because I hadn't seen anything that was absolutely conclusive. This all looks like tree stump and different, trees that have maybe been busted off, but where's the real evidence? This is fun. Dave Weiss sent me this last week.
Yeah, Doc, it's going to be a hell of a long walk back to Hill Valley from here. Still the safest plan. After all, we can't risk sending you back into a populated area or to a spot that's geographically unknown. You don't want to crash into some tree that once existed in the past.
You don't want to crash into some tree that once existed in the past.
Little taste of truth in plain sight, perhaps. Yeah, so I don't know about the stumps. There's a lot of different theories out there. Roger Spurr thinks it's a Titan's Achilles tendon. I think that's unlikely. Most people that have dug into this think that it's either tree. There's another guy who's presented this theory, which I think is interesting. Hold on, let me get back there. There's mushroom species called Stemonitis. There's like 30 different varieties of it, and it grows in this exact fashion. So when it comes to the Titanic trees, you're talking about trees that were literally 6, 8, 10 miles wide at the stump, if not larger. And if that's the case, then something like Devil's Tower would have been, tiny compared to those trees. So is it possible that this is something that was more like a fungus or slime mold growth that was growing on one of the great trees? It's just something that's fun to ponder. Regardless of whether you believe in the stumps or not, I'm fully convinced that the great trees were real. And I have a video called The Great Trees Were Real. Here's proof. that you can check out. But by far and away, the best proof of that is coming from Hangman 1128. These are all of his photographs. And he shows all of the different ways in which these manifest. You can see the tree grain there. The sap of the tree is petrifying to quartz. To me, this is a self-evident proof. You can just see the tree grain. It's manifesting in all of its majesty and complexity and detail. It's scalable, it's fractal, and the tiny trees break down and petrify in an exact identical fashion to what you're seeing here. But these are on a scale that's hard to fathom. Something that would be an inch wide in one of these trees would be hundreds of feet across or more. And you can see that that's clearly the knot of a tree. And for those who can't see that, I'm sorry, but I think you might need to learn to open your eyes, but that's just my opinion. These are just tiny, tiny little chunks of what might have even been branches in these great trees. And I could do an entire presentation just on that subject. So what constitutes evidence? This is one of the ways that they try and debunk it, the square cube law, but it's entirely based on gravity. They tell us, oh, nothing could have been alive in the Silicon era. The idea that there was a Silicon era is silly. I don't think that they were silica to begin with. I think that they transmuted. And so there's a whole bunch of videos I've done looking at all the different ways, the elements, the salt mines, the tipuis. I think these were, one last little thing. This is incredibly compelling evidence, in my opinion. And this is from the Action Adventure Twins. They go spelunking down these things. They go down 500 feet, and then they go through some snaking passage, and then they go down another 500 feet. And you can see that the banding goes all the way down. They want us to believe that's sedimentary layering. But what you find is that there's no water erosion or anything. These are just rough, and it's one band and then another and then another. And it's just like it's exactly how trees go. And I theorize that that's because there are big channels inside the trees and that the waters of the deep can come up through them. And I think that might be
Thanks, Mike.
It for the presentation. Yeah.
All right.
Oh, one last.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Take your muscle and joint aches away with JJ's. Text CBD to 920-382-7720 for $50 off a 3-pack of amazing JJ's natural CBD rub and or a 3-pack of 3,000 milligram CBD veggie capsules, 100 count. Best balm and capsules on the plain earth. Made organic with bee's knees strain hemp. Extracted with dry ice bubble hash method, so never any harmful solvents. Check out our testimonials. Visit JJsCBDRub.com.